KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Sunny and breezy tomorrow, the high in the low 50s.
We should not hold the middle class hostage while we debate tax cuts for the wealthy. We should at least do what we agree on, and that's to keep middle class taxes low.
Going over part of the fiscal cliff and raising taxes on the top two rates would cost our economy more than 700,000 jobs.
I don't remember ever not hearing music. I don't remember no point in life when music was, when it was like so dried up I didn't hear anything.
Taj Mahal on music in his life. That's coming up in about 10 minutes, 15 minutes. First, we're going to take a look at what looks, what the fiscal cliff looks like as you peer over the top. House Speaker John Boehner, House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, they all have gone to the White House to meet with the president today. Jill Jackson is Capitol Hill's news producer for CBS News. Hello, Jill.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I am good. What does the fiscal cliff look like from right on the edge where you're standing?
Well, at the moment, it's like everything's happening in slow motion. You know, the election happened last week. Everyone was saying, you know, there's this urgency, you know, the fiscal cliff has to be averted. We need to get to work right away. So they scheduled a meeting for Friday of this week, the very last day of the week, right before the House is going to go out of session for all next week. And the Senate will likely only be in session for a day or two next week because of the Thanksgiving holiday and the president's going on a big international trip. So there's, while everyone's saying there's this urgency, today is the first meeting since the election of the big players, and it doesn't look like there's going to be any major work done in the next week.
Do you suppose they're past staking out their positions and now sort of working amongst themselves to figure out what a compromise will look like?
I think that they understand that the deadline is one will be actually be their friend. That getting things done right now with getting things done too fast in some ways could cause both sides of the aisle, the conservative end of the Republican Party, the liberal end of the Democratic Party, to call foul and try and gum up the works by being intransigent, and which could ultimately kill any kind of deal. Because at the end of the day, if they're able to reach a deal by the end of the year, you know, there are going to be some people who are paying some higher taxes. There are going to be some spending cuts that people aren't happy with. It's going to be a combination of things that people say that everyone's going to have something to hate if they're able to do it.
Jill Jackson is a CBS News producer in Washington, D.C. What did Nancy Pelosi say when she was leaving this meeting?
She said that, you know, basically she said that they're confident they can come to an agreement and avoid the fiscal cliff before Christmas. So that is something, you know, she said that. Speaker Boehner said he thought the meeting was constructive. It seems like everyone's saying that that it was a positive meeting. The meeting went just about an hour. Before the meeting took place, the president congratulated Speaker Boehner on his birthday, which is tomorrow. He's going to be 63. So it was a lot of pleasantries. Now, basically, did we get any further than what we've been hearing, which is, you know, President, here is what we know. We know that there are some lines in the sand where the president says he won't accept any extension of tax rates for families making over $250,000 a year, unless someone finds a way, another way for the rich to pay their fair share in taxes. Speaker Boehner has said he's open to revenues, but no increase in tax rates. He wants it all done through closing of loopholes, essentially. Though some have said that is very difficult to make the math add up if the goal is to come up with about $1 trillion in deficit reduction. And Leader Pelosi said yesterday that she thinks entitlements like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid should be handled completely separately from this deal. So on the one hand, people are talking nice, but the differences are still very real.
So they're going to try to do Medicare and Social Security separate from this deal?
Well, that's what Leader Pelosi was calling for. So the Republicans want to have entitlement reform as part of any big package that would help with the deficit reduction. So, you know, you have they've put ideas on the table that would raise the Medicare entitlement age, that would put it on more of a sliding scale so that the wealthy pay more than lower income folks. That's known by many as the Paul Ryan plan, but also turning it into some sort of voucher-like program as well. So the Republicans want entitlement reform like that to be part of the discussion. Democrats, that is their holy grail. They do not want any cuts to those programs at this moment. They've been open to some sort of changing the inflation rate related to how they calculate what you get from Social Security, that kind of some sort of little things. But the Democrats really say that that should be handled separately, and that this deficit reduction package should be more about tax. They would like to see higher taxes.
Wait, so perhaps I don't understand what the rules are for avoiding or leaping Evel Knievel style over the fiscal cliff. Don't they have to have a combination of cuts and, what's the rules for the fiscal cliff to be avoided?
Well, there technically are no rules. They could throw it all out, and they don't have to do anything. But basically, to achieve a big deal, everyone agrees that certain things, although not everyone clearly, but most outside observers feel that everything needs to be on the table, which means entitlements should be on the table, taxes should be on the table, an effort at tax reform should be on the table, and other spending cuts to other parts of the budget. But everyone wants to sort of take out their piece and protect sort of what is most important to them. So for the Democrats, that's the entitlements. For the Republicans, that's the current Bush tax rates. And although they say they will compromise on that if you do full comprehensive tax reform, bringing down the rates and closing loopholes, so maybe corporate jet owners don't get a tax break. Those kinds of loopholes, but they won't go into some of the thorny issues like whether the mortgage interest deduction would have to be eliminated to achieve that deficit reduction. So far, President Obama has said that he thinks everything should be on the table, but it's going to be messy, and without rules and without any sort of structure at this point, even to get a deal done, it's going to be a heavy, heavy lift to get this done in just a few weeks.
Boy, maybe it'll just be a fiscal lip in the end and not a cliff at all.
Right. Well, and remember that if they do nothing and we do go over the fiscal cliff, it means almost assuredly means a recession in the early part of next year, and could do big damage to the economy. And everyone would see a tax increase as well. You have, your average family could be paying $3,500 more in taxes next year if Congress can't get a deal done. So in some ways, they do have that pressure that I think a lot of Americans want them to get a deal. It's just difficult to get every American and every lawmaker to agree exactly how that deal should be made.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Average, but not for all of us. All right. Jill, you've been on the Petraeus stakeout?
Yes. I have been in the very... There's an underground area of the Capitol, three floors below the main Capitol, called the Capitol Visitors Center, and that is where the House Intelligence Secure Briefing Room is, and that is where General Petraeus came this morning to brief members on the events in Benghazi, the attacks in Benghazi, and the timeline and response, the timeline of events of the actual attack and the response afterwards. He managed to, in full CIA style, get into that secure room without a single photographer or camera person getting a picture of him. He managed to do the same when he went over to the Senate side to brief those senators on the Intelligence Committee there. But basically what we've learned from lawmakers emerging from those briefings are that Petraeus said that it was pretty clear that it was a terrorist attack within 24 hours, that there had been the message, you had Susan Rice, the UN secretary, going on the Sunday shows saying that it was not necessarily a terrorist attack, and that was because she's been reading these talking points that were provided to administration officials, agencies, and members of Congress that said that the attack seemed to be spontaneous. She was working off those talking points. Now, Petraeus told members this morning that actually the attacks were that actually the initial language on that memo with those talking points said that Al-Qaeda, there was evidence of Al-Qaeda involvement. And somehow between the CIA's initial drafting of that and that those talking points being put in front of Susan Rice and given to lawmakers, that language was changed to extremist elements rather than Al-Qaeda. So that made it a little murky as to whether it truly was a terrorist attack or not. What we did not get the answer to is why that was changed, though one lawmaker suggested it may have been that the initial talking points were classified and then the talking points that went out to everyone were the unclassified version, but no one has been able to say definitively yet.
And how does the very unbiased House Intelligence Committee member Peter King, who has been talking to reporters, seem to think? What does he say has happened?
Well, he said that he still has questions. He still wants to hear from other members of the intelligence community, and he says the investigation is not yet over. He said that, and what we've been told is that lawmakers have seen over the past couple days a video. Although Peter King did not directly say that he'd seen the video, but he talked about the attack itself, and that the first part of the attack, the first attack, did seem spontaneous. But the second was clearly more, or the second, which was on an annex on the grounds, was definitely more of a planned attack. You had mortar rounds. It was clearly a more organized effort that is now considered to be a terrorist attack. Pete King said that he just wants more answers as to why there was not a faster response from people going in to help. Just also wants lawmakers still say that they have questions about the timeline of events, despite the fact that that they've now seen a video over the past. Pete King actually saw the video yesterday. That is a mix of drone footage and like a closed circuit footage as well. We're told it's 45 minutes at least, and that now the intelligence officials are trying to put out an unclassified version for the public, so that some of us could see for ourselves what the attack looked like.
So, Jill Jackson, last question. What response has there been among other Congress members to John McCain and Lindsey Graham's call for a Watergate-style hearings about this issue?
Well, most importantly, the people who would make that call are people like Speaker John Boehner. And he has said up till now that he feels the committees of jurisdiction, the intelligence committees, the House Oversight Committee, he feels that the Armed Services Committee, he feels they're doing a sufficient job. They've been having hearings and briefings every day. He feels that at this point, he does not feel any kind of special committee or commission or investigator is needed, but he definitely emphasizes the at this point of that, and so we shall see. But I think that at this point, that's looking pretty unlikely.
All right, Jill Jackson, entire interview and no mention of the affair, and we'll leave it that way. Jill Jackson is CBS News producer covering Capitol Hill. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday. Coming up, conversation with Taj Mahal.
Good morning, it's 9:18. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. I'm Andy Hurst. A quick traffic note to tell you about. Both directions of State Route 520 across Lake Washington will be closed this weekend, starting at 11 o'clock tonight, reopening at 5 a.m. on Monday morning.
Support for KUOW comes from Aegis Living, a senior living company specializing in assisted living and memory care, fostering social interaction, nutrition, and dedication to resident care. More information by calling 888-222-3202.
This week on This American Life, a music professor believes that he's found a way to kill microorganisms with sound waves, and he starts to wonder if they could destroy cancer cells.
No chemo, no radiation, no cutting. You walk in and they have a large bulb and they turn it on for 3 minutes, and inside of a month, you're done.
He teams up with a real cancer researcher, a serious one, and gets unexpected results.
This American Life, tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. We have clouds and 43 degrees in Seattle, expecting a high today around 50. Forecast says it's going to be cloudy today with a chance of showers. Same for tonight, clouds, chance of showers, the low in the mid-40s.
Two-time Grammy-winning artist Taj Mahal is in our studios, celebrating 40-plus years playing music with a new retrospective album. But we're not talking about legacy, right? Because the music always moves on.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know about it's just that musicians, when you get called to be a musician, it's not, you know, you saw somebody on the stage and you obsessed on the fact that they had something that you didn't have at that moment. Therefore, you wanted it and you went after that. It's a deeper calling than that. It's ancient. And when you get called, like I was called as a young child, listening to it, not only listening to it, but in the dream space, which I didn't even, wasn't until the 60s and I started being able to understand what was actually happening, what the transference of the energy from your ancestors through your DNA, you know, and all that kind of stuff like that, which is esoteric, you know, but, and, you know.
But real.
But yeah, but very real, you know, and anyway, so. You know, it's like it's a big stage, and you come on and you do your thing, and then it's time to take your bow. You know.
You know, I was listening. Somehow, I ended up through some roundabout way to a band called Love.
Oh, from sure. Arthur Lee.
Arthur Lee.
Yeah, and what did Brian something or another?
Oh, I can't remember his name. I'll look it up.
Yeah, yeah.
But one of those artists. And one of those creators of music that, though listed as one of the top, you know, albums of the era, kind of slipped by the wayside.
Well,
and yet
industry.
For him, yeah, it's the industry. But for the music is still vital. I was amazed at
it. Yeah, it predates all the punk, all the alternative.
All the psychedelic.
Everything.
Yeah, the guy was amazing.
Unbelievable. But that was the industry. The industry was not unable to handle black musicians and white musicians working together in front of a white audience. They just couldn't handle it.
Didn't even know how to think about it.
They couldn't handle it, you know, and they didn't. And a lot of incredible bands, black rock bands, mixed bands from Mexican and black, you know, European American and black, you know, African American, they just got left by the wayside. I mean,
you guys, right? Rising Suns?
Rising Suns was the same thing, you know. I mean, what they do is they decommission you by signing you, you know, and then you think something's really happened. But, you know, that's all the negative. What that did was drive me to do the stuff that I did, that I wanted to hear. Because, I mean, you know, if you really study what's going on with the music, and I'm not talking about notes, I'm just talking about the history of the music and the history of the music business and all who was pulling the strings behind it and the gangsters and the management and the agents and the syndicate, all the stuff, you know, that made the scene, that set the scene for rock and roll. Right now, there's a great book out called The Chitlin Circuit by this guy named Lauterbach. And that, the Chitlin Circuit, is just phenomenal because it shows you what was the road that set up from rock and roll. I don't know what his first name is, but Lauterbach. Lauterbach.
You know, sometime, about 5 months ago, Buddy Guy was here.
Oh, yeah, Buddy, good people.
And, yeah, and he was talking about that decision he made and the people he encountered once he got to Chicago, and how it was, who was it in the back of his car that said, you know, keep doing this, gave him some chicken and some beans that he had picked up because Buddy Guy hadn't eaten in a while, said, keep doing this, but you know, don't, you're going to be fighting a lot of people.
Yeah.
I thought that was amazing.
Oh,
amazing
story. Yeah. Well, the Chicago scene was incredible. I mean, you don't have to even deal with the blues guys. Just go back to, like, King Oliver and Louis Armstrong.
Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
Excuse me, that's
probably
who it
Muddy.
Was.
It was probably Muddy, because Muddy was really he helped a lot of guys come in the town, you know. But you go back to Louis Armstrong and King Oliver, and, you know, I mean, Chicago was, like, a mob town. You know, and so, hey, and the mob liked the music.
They liked the music, but they wanted to control. Did they want to control the music?
I think once it got into the record part of the business, you know, when, because I mean, the first records were just to advertise that you were coming to play live. Then they started realizing that, well, wait a minute, we could make the money here.
I can't remember who Buddy Guy's one of the first people he was working with. He liked him. He was a pretty good guy, but he was connected in debt. And all of a sudden, the guy was gone, and the records were gone. Yeah. And then they found the guy floating in Lake Michigan.
There you go. You know, yeah, because, but also, too, you know, the other side of that coin was, you know, you had an underserved public, you know, that came out of the South in droves. And, you know, the so-called legitimate musical organizations, record companies, et cetera, publishing companies, you know, they were not interested. So you had people like Leonard Chess. Sid Nathan, yeah, and, you know, and Joe Tarsha and many other, the Bahari brothers and this one and that one. And then later on, and the other side of that, to counteract that, you had Don Roby and all those guys like that who were actually working the Chitlin circuit, which started out earlier, you know, even earlier than that. I mean, it just was that, okay, well, where are you going to play? You know, how are you going to bring this stuff around? And who's the reigning king of the Chitlin circuit today is Bobby Rush.
Really?
Oh, Bobby Rush is deep Chitlin. I'm serious.
And Bobby Rush, former Black Panther congressman? Different Bobby Rush.
He's from
Chicago.
I don't care, but they ain't talking about that guy. Bobby Rush is from home of Louisiana, you know. And, him. I mean, the guys, if you want to talk about Chuck Berry paid the least amount of time in the Chitlin circuit.
Because he became big.
He was able to morph right into what was happening in the national music scene. And a few other people came along after, like Richard and Fats Domino.
Oh, Bobby Rush, the musician.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right.
Bobby. Yeah, you knew that all along.
No, I didn't. I have the internet in front of me, sir.
Well, I hope that's what I said. No, I knew that. But I'm just being smart on your time. You know.
Taj Mahal is here. All right. By the way, So Buddy Guy talked about in his biography, talked about these clubs, though they changed in the mid to late 60s. Early 60s, the clubs in Chicago, where he was talking about especially, were just vibrant.
Yeah.
Just full of people,
Teresa,
out dancing.
Mother Blues.
Yeah. Did you?
Silvio.
Did you go to some of those clubs?
I went to hear music there, yeah. I didn't get to play them because it was, you know, they were really, you know, they really looked out for the guys from Chicago, so.
And there was a hierarchy too. You had
Yeah. Well, I could play, but it wasn't the issue. But that was their scene. But as that scene dried up, you know, had those guys had started realizing, see, they left out of there and went down to the Chitlin circuit, and then went back to Chicago. And then if they were lucky enough, if somebody from the outside, particularly the English groups, got excited about them, then their name would get out and get in amongst all these young kids, and then their records would be sought after. You know, I mean, there's always the blues mafia, you know, and blues Nazis are out there always trying to decide, you know, what they know is more better than, you know, the development of the music. The music was developing along pretty daggone good until all these people got in there and started messing with it. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's just constipated on itself. It can't go nowhere. I'm serious. It's the truth. Well, I mean, what happens? Look at rap, man. 30 years. The first 10 or 15 years of rap, car would pull past you and your hair would stand up on edge. Go like, did I just hear that? And it was an affront to your senses. Now, I don't care how loud they play it. It's all computerized drivel.
But you hear it. Different sounds emerging in different places that are, and that's what's so interesting.
Outside, yeah. Once you understand that people outside don't have to, you know, pander to whatever the, you know, the standard is here. I mean, that to me, the best, you asked me, you were saying something about where music is going. The best thing that happened to music recently was rap. And like bebop, you know, like blues, like jazz, those are all outlaw musics. Even gospel was an outlaw music. You know,
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, because the designer of gospel is one Thomas A. Dorsey, who used to be known as Georgia Tom, the blues singer, and so he and people like Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who was really a gospel, you know, a disseminator of gospel all over the place, and she worked back and forth with like Andy Kirk and Lucky Millinder's band, and you know, I mean, she, I don't know if you've ever spent any time looking at her on YouTube. Oh, seriously,
look her up.
Oh my God. It's like that. You talk about somebody that Elvis Presley was excited by. Everybody talks about, you know, Arthur Big Boy Crudup, but he and lots of the early rockers were nuts about Rosetta Tharpe. Rosetta Tharpe was a serious guitar player. She started out playing like a national duolian, and then she started. She played some sort of Gibson, solid body Gibson, and we're talking about play. We're not talking about jangalanga, jangalanga. Notes playing with a jazz band, kill on it. And she, but you know, this people that were doing that, you know, the religious community was like, they're not having no blues notes and no Christian music. And it took a while. Now we're looking back and nobody thinks of it. People don't think of blues as being a radical music, you know, and then early rap. I mean, you know, now it's like, it's already happened. But when it was coming down the pike, it, to me, it was like bebop. It was radical, you know, and it shook people up. And, you know, it was a point of view. I mean, if you really see where these kids were, is that who helped them get the instruments? Nobody. Was there, they shut down all the music in the community? The only way they could learn the music was off of the records that they heard. So, you know, here you got the music, which is happening in its natural form, or as natural as it can be. And then it gets recorded. And then from the recordings, it comes into the people. And then these kids are younger, and they hear that. And then that's what they go back to. They don't go back to traditional rhythms or anything that's structured like that. Plus, aside from that, was that by that time, everybody was into, like, Luther Vandross. And, you know, Luther had everybody, had, you know, the women mesmerized. And the young kids coming up, they wanted something hard. That's why I Walked This Way got up in there, you know, because it was like, yeah, some edge to it. But if you ultimately think about it, where does those guys come? They're playing rock. Where does rock go back to? Blues. You know, where does the blues go back to? It's the same thing.
I was always struck by how interesting it was that in the 70s, those guys were using, they were making their technology. They're creating the turntables that would work. They were figuring out with masking tape and arms how they could make music.
Yeah.
But that's
the mother of necessity. You know, that's the mother of invention. You know, and necessity is the mother of invention. And it's like, what you going to do? You know, nobody's paying no attention to what you're doing. You know, so you have need a block party, climb up a pole, hook up, just the same way that Jamaica. And it was a lot apart from the Caribbean people, particularly the Jamaicans, you know, who used to have big sound systems down in
all right.
Oh, yeah. And when they moved up in it, because I met half my family, my stepfather from the time I was like 13, 14 years old, is Jamaican. So I grew up in that. And my own father was from St. Kitts and Nevis till he passed. You know, so I was inside of both a Southern and a Caribbean harmonic. I'm a harmonic in that thing.
You know what? On that note, can we listen to one of my favorite songs?
Which is?
St. Kitts Woman.
Oh, okay.
1973 for Mo Root. So it's Taj 2. If you get a chance on that. Let's listen to a little bit of that. You know, when I recorded this in my computer, I only got one channel.
I don't know what the problem is.
I do.
What?
Unfortunately, I have a bad cable. I thought I fixed it.
Okay.
See, there's technology for you again. technology. And
I know right away that wasn't it because I could hear, I was hearing the echo.
Yeah.
That was on it.
From the other side. Yeah.
But this song, you see.
This, I love this song. This, I love this whole album.
This, yeah, well, it was an exciting album, you know. The reason that it came about was that one album, 1, 2, and 3 were in, you know, Taj Mahal, The Natural Blues, and Giant Step and the Old Folks at Home. Those albums cut anything that was happening out there, but the industry didn't respond to what the true value of what those albums were.
But the buyers did. No, I see that in everybody's collection.
Yeah, but that's everybody you know.
Yeah, I know. Right? That's right.
Man, I can tell you that everybody I know eats collard greens. I think the world eats collard greens. Come on now. Wake up. You know, that's everybody, you owe everybody. You know, but it, no, it, but those first three albums, you know, and then I started, you know, doing soundtracks and was involved in Sounder. And then I put together the big band, you know, because it's like, what I just realized is that, you know, they're going to do the same thing they did to the old blues guys to you. Is that they're going to dip their straws into what it is that you're coming up with. They're going to draw a lot of inspiration from it, but they will not acknowledge what you're doing in terms of being able to move that to another level. And that's just the way that was just the way it was. So once I discovered that for myself and just, you know, didn't take offense, I just got busy with the music. And so that was what Mo Roots was about. That's what is that, you know, there were one, how many albums? Let's see, Sounder.
Oh, afterwards.
There was Sounder. Then there was the real thing with the tubas, which was moved with to bring jazz and blues and those lines together. And then I did two solo albums, Recycling the Blues and other related stuff. Remember what I said? Recycling. Who was saying that? Nobody. All right. And then the next one was Ooh So Good in Blues, and then Mo Roots.
So what, did Recycling Blues made the Blues Mafia mad, or what? They were okay?
They were mad with me all the time because, it's like I had the right to be able to hear the music the way it was. Well, who were they? You know, I didn't run around with a chauffeur blowing it saying, my name is so-and-so, saying, you know, I didn't do anything like that, you know. I was playing the music. I was a young guy coming through. I should be relating to the music that I was relating to. I mean, you know, skip the generation. Now you got Chocolate Drops, you got Ruthie Foster, you got this one, you got that one, you got Kevin Moe, you got, Guy Davis, you got Alvin Youngblood Hart, you got Corey Harris, you know, and a myriad of other wonderful young people, you know, who are coming along, you know, and not so young because they've been at it for 25
years. Yeah, Kevin Moe's not a young man,
you know,
is he?
Well, he's young. He's quite a bit younger than I am, you know.
So are you saying that Giant Step and Mo Roots, they didn't sell well?
Comparatively. You know.
70, so what are we talking here? 74. I don't know what the major selling album was in 1974.
Yeah, that wasn't the issue. The point of it was is that we worked the whole thing. We had a single off of, like, say, Mo Roots. Mo Roots had a single called Why Did You Have to Desert Me? Okay, that sold 10,000 pieces in Philadelphia. The record company couldn't figure out what to do. You sell 10,000 45s in Philadelphia, and yet they don't know what to do.
When did you take over your own, you know, control of your music?
I got control of music from the beginning.
Well, I mean, in terms of selling it, distributing it, having to rely on a record company to figure out something.
Yeah, well, I would buy music in bulk from them and sell it on my own.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, all of it. See, what happened, the great divide for me was, I was with the Rising Suns, all the musicians were signed. Okay, that band, because of politics and everything else, just started to implode. Everybody said, look, let's get out of this before we lose our positivity toward each other as friends. So people made a move. While I was still on the label, I called up Clive Davis. I spoke with Clive Davis. Clive Davis sent out to me. We had a conversation, a long, good, nice conversation. And he sent David Rubinson out to me. Listen, here's one of our company staff producers. If you like him, you know, we'll see what we can do. If you don't, we'll try something. Came out, David was perfect. Because what David did exactly what Damon Dash did for Jay-Z. He did the business, and I did the music. He left me alone from all the way from the beginning. So all the music that I was used to playing was exactly what was in my head, no matter what the record company was about with other people. Yeah, you can sit in all those meetings, and you can do this and you can do that, and your music still sounds like it's dead, and this is not dead music. And so I would rather have the music live so that you listen to it, so that listening to it from this point in my life, I did what I wanted to do.
All right, I'm going to take a break. We'll go out because I want to come back to ask you about Hawaii and how Hawaii has affected you. This is Living on Easy from Hanna Pepe Dream. That's 2000 already with the Hula Blues Band. I got that wrong. That's Zanzibar, 2005.
That's right.
Kona meets the Cultural Music Club of Zanzibar, which we will talk about as well.
No, they're not on that. That's Angelique Kidjo singing. And then
that's the name of the album.
Yeah. Maestro. Not, there's another Zanzibar, which is on the Muku channel.
You're right, I got it wrong. I got it wrong all day today.
Hey. As they say in Hawaii, eh, that's your kuleana.
We have cloudy skies and 44 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 50 today. Forecast says it's going to be cloudy all day with a chance of showers. Same for tonight, cloudy skies, chance of rain, the low in the mid-40s. It's going to be cloudy, rainy, and breezy tomorrow, the high in the low 50s.
Support for KUOW comes from Regents Blue Shield. Regents, your health, connected. Regents Blue Shield serves select counties in the state of Washington and is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
This week on American Roots, El Sabor Latino in American music. From the West Coast, it's Mexican-American rockers Los Lobos. To the East Coast, salsa of Oscar Hernandez and the Spanish Harlem Orchestra. Plus a performance by San Antonio's queen of conjunto accordion, Eva Ibarra. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
American Roots, every Sunday night at 8 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's
9:42. All right, this is Zanzibar from Maestro. Taj Mahal is here correcting me because I wrote the wrong things down. That's bad.
That's okay.
I apologize.
It happened.
Well, all right, so then I will ask you about Hawaii, and then I will ask you about these other two albums.
Okay.
When did you first go to Hawaii to live?
I think 81. But I'd gone through there. I've been going to Hawaii since the 60s. And then I'd been inquisitive about Hawaiian music since I was probably like 8 or 9 years old.
What do you hear there that really gets your thinking?
Well, first of all, the humanity that comes through with the tempo of the music. They're not concerned now they say the continent, but the mainland tempo. They have their own tempo. you can feel that they're, you feel just a deep resonating human soul through their music. You know, I never really heard that outside of African music, Caribbean music, Latin music, you know, or deep gospel music, you know, just certain types of jazz. I never heard that until I heard them. And that made me really inquisitive. Was this just the way music certain gets to, or is this really representative of who these people are? And so it was always something that was interesting. The sound was like, you know, you didn't take you but a note and a half, or a note, to know that where it was coming from out there. So was it the environment? Was it the people? What was it? You know, and so so we zip up to the 60s and we start going over there, and somehow I'm not making any headway with where the so-called real Hawaiians are. And but then little by little it started happening. I started going over playing solo, and then moved over there in 81, and for about 20 years I was there. So, you know, and I didn't play for like the first 5 years over there. I did not want to establish myself, my family, my kids. I didn't want them to, you know, them to be about, you know, having to deal with that. This is what I did. They needed to really develop themselves in there and get to be a part of the culture, which they did. The girls hula, they surf, they bodyboard, they boogie board, they talk pigeon, all kind of stuff, you know. And but then after about 4.5 years, I played, and they were shocked that so many people knew what was going on. We sold out.
Well, you know, let's see, Sacred Island and also Hanna Pepe Dream.
Yeah,
and those albums, there are cuts where it's an ensemble.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, you're part of this musical experience.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what happened. I mean, is that I could play, they could play, but there was a point when we didn't understand each other's music, and that was the turnarounds. They didn't understand blues turnarounds, and I did not understand, Hawaiian hula turnarounds. And that was our exchange. And once we sat out, I mean, literally, it was like, you go, bring the kids, go over to Michael Barreto's house. Hey, how you guys doing? We come over on the weekend. Wayne coming down, blah, blah. He coming with his wife. Everybody sleeping in sleeping bags. You know, we're cooking out on the outside. We go fishing. We catch a bunch of mahi-mahi. We come in back cooking. The women have got everything all set up. The kids are crawling around. People are nursing. And we're playing music. And it was like, this is what it's all about. The backyard guys. I mean, you talk about musicians per square mile in Hawaii. Man, there's more. The only other place I know is either Africa. No, just a couple other places. Africa or the Caribbean. I'm sure in Central and South America too. But, you know, that there's that much music. You see a guy going along the road with a cutlass. He's just cutting along the road. Hey, Uncle John. Hey, how you doing? Blah 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 blah. Okay. So next two years later, you're at somebody's baby luau after a year. Then the baby lives a year, and they have a big luau for the baby. Everybody comes in, gives a cheer to kid up because he made it this far. And he goes, you see Uncle John play? Hey, I never know you play. What else? He says, you never ask. You know? But, I mean, these guys humble, incredible players, man.
You know, it just occurs to me, I have not said that Taj Mahal is performing at Demetrio's Jazz Alley for the next, eight shows, right?
Yeah.
Starting tonight, Taj Mahal Trio.
Yeah.
So Taj Mahal's the Jazz Alley for the next 8 nights.
Yeah, well, everybody's going to be happy this year because last year we went to Europe during the Thanksgiving time, and people were, like, distressed because we have this sort of a ritual. So we won't do that again, folks. Don't worry. It was just something that it was like, we had to try it. Man, it turned out really great because we got to play with a lot of great African musicians and some really great American musicians that were there.
That's the exchange, too, you're talking about when you play with people like that, right?
Yeah, well, the whole point is that look, here, quick one. Cuba, Puerto Rico, Haiti, Santo Domingo, all the islands, Mexico, Central America, South America, Brazil, blah, 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 blah. No matter what you say, Jimmy, all of them, no matter what you say, you don't hear the blues coming from there this way. You hear the blues only coming from the United States in that direction. Okay? That's because of the different style of colonialism, for sake of a better word, you know, that was happening here in the United States, which treated the soul in a different way, which, when its reaction to that colonialism, was not melancholy, not longing, because it was totally discombobulated in every kind of way. In Cuba or any of these other places, they brought whole families over with whole mindsets and whole traditions that, even though they were suppressed, they still had their family that they could communicate to. Here, the families were just totally disenfranchised. And consequently, this is what we have today amongst the young people who are told, you know, they got the warrior gene, right? But that's about all they got right, you know. But anyway, is that until the blues went out of here and into these places and created something, reggae, you know, early ska, you know, all those kind of things from the boogie-woogie beat, you know. I mean, you can follow it all around the world. And this is what I'm about. As a blues man, instead of being, there's a blues man, everybody know that like to play the blues. You know, it's like, it's time for you know, the blues man to stand up and say, well, I'm checking out my cousin down in Brazil, you know, and he's playing like this. His name is Jorge Ben. Or, you know, or Hermeto Pascal, or I'm listening to, you know, Franco over in Africa, you know, and I don't have to be told by some, you know, ethnomusicologist, well, here, blind Bartiminus, this is Mugambo from Uganda. Hello, Mugambo. You know, it's like, what is this? You know, my brain is working. I'm an intelligent man, you know, and it's like, So you know, you have to deal with these, like, blues people who are like, you know, well, you know, it's not really the, you know, the real deep delta, you know. I'm saying, excuse me, and who are you to tell me about the real deep delta?
What? I think you said that last year when we were here, that you wanted to find some of them and sit them down and you know, maybe hit them over the head a little bit.
No, I understand it's a scientific method, but that's not all there is, you know.
Hey, can I ask you a last question? You miss Thanksgiving. You don't have Thanksgiving with your family here? Did your family come here for Thanksgiving?
No. My daughter Mia had aunts, had two aunts and two uncles that were living in Vashon Island, and the men worked for Boeing. And they built their kind of like real nice, you know, sort of homesteads over there. And she came out and was living with her daughter over there for quite a while. She's since moved back to Grand Rapids. And in fact, I was talking to her yesterday. She's really doing great. And my granddaughter's doing really great.
So what do you do for Thanksgiving? Do you make something up in your hotel room?
No.
Your apartment?
No. What we've done every year is that the musicians and sometimes family members or friends of family get together and everybody cooks. And we we invite people over, and then, well, I usually do two deep fried turkeys every year. One is for us, and the other one go for the club, and whatever leftovers go to the club. I mean, they do like about four or five dishes every year.
All right, I'm just checking.
Yeah.
Hey, it's your happy 70th birthday?
Yeah, every day.
Every day. Happy birthday. 8 nights, 13 shows. Taj Mahal, November 16th to 18th, 20 to 25th at Jazz Alley. I really
make you dance.
Which is the whole point, yes?
That's right.
I appreciate you talking to us.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you coming in. Here, we'll go out. Last year you were here. You played some music with your trio. We'll go out with a little bit of that. Kester Smith, Bill Rich, Taj Mahal. Thank you, sir.
All right. My pleasure. Looking forward, guys. See you there. Mean a world Maybe try living by yourself.
The sound of the week.
Oh, that's a little bit of Velcro that was sent to us by weekday listener Delia. Hey, I know her. She's part of the local IATSE 887 wardrobe crew working on Wicked at the Paramount. They spend several days cleaning and maintaining costumes, and once a week they take time to clean the Velcro closures with tiny wire brushes, and that's our sound of the day. All right, so as you go about your weekend, getting ready perhaps for Thanksgiving, what sounds are you hearing? Maybe you'll be hearing Taj Mahal at Jazz Alley, or you'll be seeing the last show of Wicked that's at the Paramount, cleaning Velcro out of your various Velcro enclosures. Nick Bond, I got a little excited there. So tell me something. What can we expect for this holiday week ahead, sir?
We're going to have some rain developing later today, and that's a kind of a tune-up for the week ahead. And we look to be basically wet, windy, at least breezy at times. So the fire hose is pointed at the Pacific Northwest, and we can't precisely time the individual disturbances and exactly how they play out. But rain is on the way for the next week or so.
Oh, good. So this is just a tune-up for Thanksgiving and beyond, huh?
Right. Yeah, well, for this weekend, we're going to probably have a little bit of a break Saturday morning, and then the rain should start in earnest midday or so, and temperatures kind of mild, low 50s, lows in the low to mid-40s, snow levels kind of flirting around 4,000 feet, and so unfortunately, it's not quite cold enough to really pile up the snow in the ski areas and so forth. But on the other hand, it's not looking so warm that we're going to have the torrential rains that lead to major flooding. And so it's Northwest November weather on the way.
Well, I guess we have to expect that.
Oh, yeah.
We have to expect it. All right, so what are you thinking about your seasonal forecast that you're able to do from the Climate Prediction Center there at NOAA, Nick Bond? Are they getting better, or are they telling you things you didn't know before?
Well, they are changing, and I have been saying, and the official forecasts have been drier than normal in the Pacific Northwest, especially after the first of the year, and now their forecasts that just came out yesterday are equal chances of below normal precipitation, above normal precipitation, or near normal, and same thing in temperature. And it's if they kind of threw up their hands and said all bets are off, and I can't really blame them. The El Nino that was developing late last summer just kind of basically stopped, and while the ocean is still warmer than normal, the atmosphere is basically ignoring it. And so there's a really conflicting information about what's liable to happen this winter. And all this must sound like an admission of defeat, and the climate community isn't so happy about it, but it's just the way it is with regards to seasonal forecasts much of the time.
An admission of defeat. Well, we're not infallible. That's all it means, right?
Well, the atmosphere is a chaotic enough system that it can make its own variability without any help from El Nino, La Nina, and that sort of thing. And there are times that it's just less predictable than other times, and it looks like we're getting into a period of that type. And so it means we can, you know, just need to prepare for everything that winter can bring us.
All right. Starting with that fire hose blasting the Northwest coast. Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. Thank you, Nick. Happy holidays, too.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you. We'll review the news. Stay with us.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.